Fair warning, this show contains strong language and adult themes from time to time. Sorry, Jerry can't help it.
Sick Boy Wolfgang Productions presents The Offering with Jerry Horror. A deep dive into the history of film and its filmmakers. Mostly horror, always genre.
You've seen these guys at all the horror shows and comic cons. Now you can get your very own Inked Up merch, the finest in embroidered horror and sci-fi themed merchandise. From Lost Boys to Street Trash, from Chopping Mall to Cobra Kai, Inked Up has the best in embroidered beanies, baseball caps, and patches. Now they've even got their own Jaws-inspired Amity Island board shorts. You gotta take a look, these things are cool. Visit their Etsy store at etsy.com/shop/inkedupmerch. Are you looking to get your own printed or embroidered merch? Inked Up has been in business for over 10 years. Whether you're looking for merch for your band or you need crew logo shirts and hats for your first film production, you need some sick looking perks for your Kickstarter project, Inked Up can accommodate your needs with their custom silkscreen printing and embroidery services. Visit inkedupmerch.com and tell them Jerry sent you. Listeners and fans of The Offering can get their hands on their very own The Offering with Jerry Horror merch, now only at Tee Public. Find your own fresh The Offering with Jerry Horror high-quality merchandise, including t-shirts, hoodies, tank tops, long sleeves, stickers, and mugs. Just like the show, we've got gear that's mostly horror, always genre. The Offering with Jerry Horror Tee Public Store has everything you need to represent your favorite podcast. Folks, head on over to teepublic.com right now and pick up your very own Offering Tee today. Welcome to The Offering with Jerry Horror, the show where we can have a quiet and frank discussion as adults about the things that matter to me, or at least that I think matter to me. Please take a moment to subscribe to our show wherever you get fine podcasts, and hey, stay up to date on future episodes. Coming up, a director who had made some of the most important films of the 2000s had now put his entire career on the line. With gargantuan hits such as Pirates of the Caribbean and Tron Legacy, the studio felt they couldn't lose. Disney was ready to change the world with this movie. That was until Avatar beat them to the punch. This is the unfortunate story of a movie that I believe to be truly cursed. Stay tuned, you're not going to want to miss this. Ladies and gentlemen, friends beyond the binary, it's me, Jerry Hara, and this is The Offering. Everybody knows that I go to the movies like every week. I can't stop reviewing movies. If you follow me on Letterboxd, Instagram, any of the social media, I'm reviewing movies, and it doesn't matter what it is. Like, I'm not shy. It's been crazy. This whole year, like 2023, and especially the summer, has been nuts. Basically, I tried to get into a Barbie fan event, and I was completely locked out. It was ridiculous. They were like, there's one seat, you're kissing the screen, and it's all the way to the left, and you might have to hold some bum soda, but yeah, no, I wasn't going to see the movie like that. So I had to wait, and I wait till Monday after the film came out, and I think the preview screenings had started like on a Wednesday night. So I show up, and it's Monday morning at 9 a.m., and there's like a mother with her kids and a couple of other people, but I just can't deal with the bullshit. Listen, I'm happy that people went back to the movies. I think it's wonderful. I think what Barbie and Oppenheimer did was, it's nothing short of a miracle, because we've had this whole discussion of, oh, the movies are going away. All the cinemas are going to shutter their doors and that's it. What Barbie and Oppenheimer have proved is that people like going to the movies, and Barbie made it kind of this thing where it's like, we're getting dressed up. We're all wearing pink. We're going to take a fucking limo to go see Barbie. And personally, I'm not mad at it. I think it's pretty cool. But I really don't care about you and your pineapple-headed friends taking selfies and all this bullshit. I'm just trying to get stoned and watch a movie. Leave me the fuck alone. I'm such a grumpy old bastard. It got even to the point where, like, I couldn't see Oppenheimer because the IMAX 70 millimeter screens, You just can't get in. They're sold out. My brother just got to see it the other night. Look, like I said, I'm glad. But now I've waited for my grumpy screening of seeing this movie at 10:30 at night on like a Tuesday night so I can avoid people. Now look, I'm not sure. I might be ADD, I might be ADHD, but for whatever reason, when people are like tussling around and making noise, it's incredibly distracting to me. The movie theater is my place of worship. It's like as close as I get to going to church multiple times a week. So when I'm there, I really try to stay within my own mind and really enjoy these films and comprehend them, digest them. And that's very hard to do sometimes when you have an unruly audience. So I guess what I'm saying is, if you go to the movies this week, next week, tomorrow, tonight, make sure that you're mindful of what you're doing. People are always fiddling with wrappers. They're always tussling with something. There's always some kind of nonsense going on. If you can't shut off your phone for an hour and a half, 2 hours, your life is not worth it. Just end it all right there, because we need to disconnect. We desperately need to disconnect. Being alone in a theater with a bunch of strangers in the dark, I'm waiting for Nicole Kidman to show up. That would be a good movie, right? Nicole Kidman. That's like a Mad Magazine article. Nicole Kidman in Days of Farts. I don't even know. Yeah. So regardless, that would be a good horror movie. Like Nicole Kidman like kills people who are on the phone and texting and shit. I'd watch that. I mean, I'd watch a lot of things. The bar is very low for me. But yeah, if you're at the movies, be respectful. It's crazy too. When it comes on the screen, it's like, don't talk or text. And I'm like pointing at the screen, looking to the person next to me. I'm like, see, they said it, so don't do it. Don't do what they just said. Yo, just be respectful. This isn't just about movie theaters. This is about maybe you're sitting at a bus stop. Maybe, you know, you're on the train. Whatever it is, just try to be nice. Be a little bit mindful that there's other human beings and that it's not all about you. So, this is a really crazy episode because it's not just the story of a movie, it's the story of a director who had the best intentions, who was trying to do something really wonderful. Ultimately, too many forces basically conspired against this film. Now, I believe that this film is truly cursed, but that's for you to decide. So on the other side of this, we'll get rocking and rolling, and we're going to talk all about, I can't tell you. Stick around after the break. So we're in this craze right now where you have films like Air, you have Blackberry, you've got Flamin' Hot, even to a lesser extent, maybe like Barbie and good old Transformers. But we are in the age of like products as movies and movies as products and this weird interchangeable synergy that has been generated over the last 20 years. It's terrifying. It really is. Dude, Air was pretty good. Blackberry was pretty good. Flamin' Hot was pretty good. I've enjoyed these movies. Where am I going with this? What am I talking about? Movies like John Carter are why studios like Disney are making product movies, because they know there's an existing audience. Do you know what Etch-A-Sketch is? Okay, we're going to make a 90-minute movie about Etch-A-Sketch. It's been revealed that even like Hasbro, they're totally looking to, you know, adapt their stuff. They recently, Hasbro just sold E1 Entertainment, which controlled all the Transformers stuff and their G.I. Joe stuff, and that just got sold to Lionsgate. So now that's another, it's like these Infinity Gauntlets where you're adding another stone to it, and having those properties is pretty cool. You know, hopefully Lionsgate can exploit it, do some, you know, new interesting stuff. Unfortunately, though, this is why, even though John Carter's an adaptation, this is why we're seeing all these product films, right? Because it's a sure bet. The market research has been done. We know that you know what a Magic 8 Ball is, and now we're going to make a shitty, and yeah, you heard it here first. It's going to be a shitty PG-13 thriller with a little bit of supernatural in it. I'm like, oh, the Magic 8 Ball, you're dead. Oh no, it says I'm dead. This, I just gave you the trailer. That's what it's going to be. Regardless, We're going to get these movies. There's no way around it. Let's go back to 2012.
Let them be crushed. One blow. When I saw you, I believed that something new can come into this world.
You are John Carter of Earth?
Yes, ma'am.
Destroy our city.
That don't look like a fair fight.
You are ugly, but you are beautiful.
You will fight for us.
Get on.
We did not cause this, but this very night, we will end it.
I was too late once. I won't be again.
The true story of John Carter is of director Andrew Stanton. His passion basically fueled this film, and I truly do believe that this film is cursed. Here's what I mean by that. The reason I think this movie is cursed is because it took so many numerous attempts to make it. No matter if they took two steps forward, they took two steps back. Just like that Paula Abdul song. Do you remember that? This is MC Scat Cat. Yeah. So they really could never get ahead of the weird curse that this story, this character, all of it. It had been tried to be adapted so many times over so many years. Let me reveal this, because I have to talk about this up front. By the time John Carter gets made, it has been strip mined, literally, whether it's Star Wars, whether it's Dune, everybody took all these elements from John Carter. So by the time you get to the silver screen in 2012, you've seen all this shit. You've just seen other directors, writers regurgitate it. And that's fine, because that's a hallmark of science fiction. You know, whether it's Isaac Asimov or Ray Bradbury, they build a concept and it becomes a part of the science fiction zeitgeist. Somebody probably came up with the multiverse easily in the 1800s or whatever it was. And then slowly over time, that concept becomes very familiar to viewers. It reminds me of a quick little story. There was a Halloween script that was written, I want to say, in the early 2000s, and it was way ahead of the curve because it was a multiverse movie. It played with the continuity of the entire series. It was one of those deals where the Weinsteins were like, nope, it's too complicated. People won't get it. And that's even like sister episode this season, Last Action Hero. Was it ahead of its time? Was it too meta? Was that just too much for people to take in? We get what we call, in the early 2000s, what I call the Pixar Renaissance. Some of those influential films, style-wise, story thematically, it's Pixar. Andrew Stanton, what has he directed? WALL-E. And I'm going to tell you, WALL-E is like one of my favorite Pixar movies. I'm a sucker for robots. Anytime there's a robot, Short Circuit, Iron Giant, give me a robot. I love robots. Finding Dory, which, okay, I can't lie, I've never seen it. I've seen Finding Nemo, which is another film, but let's go into a timeline. Finding Nemo is 2003. WALL-E is 2008. Finding Dory, 2016. Did a movie called In the Blink of an Eye. That was kind of an early seminal work. A Bug's Life. So 98. 98 is really where Stanton comes onto the scene. Disney said that they lost $200 million, But the rumors say that it's closer to $300 million. I needed to get that out of the old way. The magnitude of the failure of this film, it basically changes everything, because Disney gets so dissuaded by how this film does that the direct reaction is to buy Marvel and Star Wars. I know that I'm jumping around here, but you have to follow me because there is a narrative through line to what I'm trying to tell you. So there's kind of this curse, and I call it like the Disney, it's like the boys market in the toy industry. There's like girls' toys and there's boys' toys. Disney's been very good with princesses. They've been very good with marketing to young women. And they kind of like hit this impasse in the 2000s where it was like, we don't know how to market to boys. And we need properties that boys are going to buy. They're going to buy the action figures. They're going to buy, you know, the video games. These are movies that tried to crack the boys' market, so to speak. And essentially what happens because of this, these are some of the biggest financial flops, but we'll get to that. Strange World, Lightyear, Treasure Planet, The Lone Ranger, Tomorrowland, Prince of Persia. Did you even remember Prince of Persia happened? I didn't. It's such a nothing burger of a movie. I barely remember it. All of these movies were loss leaders. The Lone Ranger sucks, but the last 20 minutes with the train sequence is really cool. That's fucking cinema. You've got Gore Verbinski. That's a real director. That's a real director making a movie, making choices, and that's the difference. It's not some stooge doing everything on a green screen. All of these, Strange World, absolute flop. We can blame the pandemic. I think we're almost far enough away. Like, dude, if your movie sucks, you can't blame the pandemic anymore. So you can't play that card. 2023. Lightyear. Jesus. Here we go. We're strip mining old content. We're trying to reformat it, resell it. And that's what producer Pete and I were talking about. You know, the Ninja Turtles, they refresh it every 3 years. Now, because these are all corporations and it's just product. Okay, where's our refresh of Toy Story? Where's the product refresh? And that's really what it is. Treasure Planet wasn't bad. It was okay. The Lone Ranger is pretty dreadful, except for that 20-minute sequence at the end. Tomorrowland, it's another nothing burger of a movie. Like, it's not a bad movie. It's not terrible, but it's not good. Disney, for whatever reason, just could not get over to that boys' market and create that fan base. Star Wars was a layup. It was kind of just like, all right, you need to make a new Star Wars. J.J. Abrams was like, I'll make a new Star Wars. I'm like, okay, so that's what you get. But Marvel was the real thing that was like, dude, we're selling action figures. People are buying merch. Because at the end of the day, I'm sorry, kids, to blow your whistle or whatever. It's just all about selling action figures and bedspreads and bath toys and officially licensed slippers. That's what this is all about. So the ingenious plan had come together to use this John Carter as a stepping stone to creating their own narrative universe. But we'll get there. A Princess of Mars is a science fantasy novel by American writer Edgar Rice Burroughs. You might know him. He's the author of Tarzan. I'm not super familiar. I'm familiar with all the adaptations. I've seen like Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan. I've seen the Skarsgård Tarzan. I've seen the cartoon. I remember the cartoons that were on Channel 2 back in the day, CBS, shout out. I'm not familiar with the work. I get it. It's totally classic literature at this point. Everybody can thumb their noses at like genre work, like whether it's horror or whether it's science fiction. But at the end of the day, like, it's classic literature. This dude's laying it down way before anybody else was. So you got to at least respect it. Princess of Mars, very daring do, very Errol Flynn, very full of swordplay, daring feats, dashing men. The novel's considered a classic example of 20th century pulp fiction, so to speak. Because again, there's people that look down on this and there's other people that elevate it and put it on a pedestal. So it just depends on kind of where you fall. It's the seminal instance of the planetary romance. This is where you haven't seen this before. This is new. This is fresh at this time. It's kind of a subgenre of science fiction. It becomes even more popular as time goes on. People are like, yo, this is a classic. If you're looking for something that's got some romance, got some fighting, got some action, little bit of social stuff, you know, like the George A. Romero stuff, little of that good stuff, some conscious things in there for you to think about. There's lots of dashing men and good old John Carter, you know, this is the perfect kind of hero. Rabid cult fan base, Edgar Rice Burroughs, Princess of Mars. I'm just mentally doing, this isn't for you. That's just for me. It's one of these things that over time, the audience grew. And the story itself is set on Mars, which is imagined as a dying planet. It's got kind of this harsh desert environment. And again, going back to when these were written, these earliest 20th century stuff, like we didn't know anything yet. We hadn't been to the moon. You know, we're 50 years off from that sort of thing. So yeah, Mars is like a harsh desert environment. You know, there's sandstorms. It's nasty. It's some people live in Arizona and they love it. I'm not saying, you know, I'm saying like Arizona is probably the closest you get to living on Mars, right? Or at least aesthetically. I'm just making this up. People are dying in Arizona. This year they had like 30 plus days of like plus 100 weather. Dear God. You know what? Nice place to visit. Just like Mars. This story is set on Mars, again, as I've aforementioned. And this was based on the work of astronomer Percival Lowell, whose ideas were widely popularized in the late 19th and early 20th century. Basically, Percival was our first guide to the stars, being able to see things with all kinds of new telescopes. A lot of it was completely new at that time, just being able to see these things. We were still kind of charting the galaxy at that point. We still are. We always will be. It's vast. Space is forever. Obviously, Princess of Mars, it's highly respected. It influences everybody. It influences Ray Bradbury, Arthur C. Clarke, Carl Sagan. You have to realize that it's a seismic shift. It's something like everybody's aware of Princess of Mars, and it's in the collective consciousness of all these incredible talents. So it's called the Barsoom series. Basically, several times, going back all the way to late 20s, early 30s, they wanted to make a series with John Carter of Mars. And they're like, hey, we can adapt this. We can do like serials. We could do like 20 of these. So director Bob Clampett approached Edgar Rice Burroughs with the idea of finally adapting Princess of Mars into a feature-length animated film. And that's crazy, the parallel between this was the only way that they thought they could adapt this was by doing it animated. And then years later, we get an animator to finally pull the trigger on it proper. So Burroughs was like really enthusiastic about this whole thing. It's like, wow. We could do live action, but think of what we could do with animation. Like, we would face so many limitations of storytelling and effects, and animation was the way to go, right? Like, to me, I mean, yeah. So there was test footage produced in 1936. It received negative reactions from film exhibitors across the U.S., especially in small towns. Many gave their opinion that the concept of an Earthman on Mars was just too outlandish an idea for Midwestern American audiences to accept. It was just too dense. They're like, this is weird, man. It's going to be feature length, and then sometimes they would be serialized. Is mom and dad, are they going to take their kids to see this? Because you have to realize where animation is. Disney is just starting, you know, the actual man, not the faceless corporation. Walt Disney is just popping off with like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Which goes on to, you know, obviously change our cultural fabric in this country forever. So the series ultimately was not given the go-ahead, and Clampett was instead encouraged to produce an animated Tarzan series. It's an offer that he later declined. I don't really want to do Tarzan. I don't want to paint jungles. I want to paint these beautiful worlds we've never seen. And I think that's what it was. These were nerds. They loved that sort of stuff. Dreaming of the stars. And it's kind of a beautiful thing. We've come to accept our modern hellscape. And we forget that there was an age when we looked to the sky in wonder. Now we're just, wondering where our Uber Eats order is. There's no wonder. It's ridiculous. I'm sorry. I don't want to be that guy, but... So Clampett recognizes the irony in MGM's decision because you guys end up doing Flash Gordon. And again, Flash Gordon is kind of John Carter again. It's Princess of Mars. He was kind of pissed about that. He was a little bit salty. You didn't want to do this, but you ended up doing Flash Gordon. But I get it. You know, I see it. And that the Flash Gordon was released the same year by Universal Studios. Flash Gordon ends up being very successful, obviously. Clampett speculated that MGM believed that serials were played only to children during Saturday matinees, whereas the John Carter tales, they were intended to be seen by adults during the evening. You know, you have a highball, you have a smoke, and you go see John Carter. It's elevated adult animation. Dude, so these guys are so ahead of the whole, like Clampett is way ahead of the game. John Carter tales, what studios wanted, they were like, if we're going to adapt this, it's got to be for kids. There's no way we can sell this to adults. The footage that Clampett produced, because it's out there, there's the test footage is out there, it was believed to be lost for many years. Nobody knew what happened to it. Did it get burnt up in a fire? No one knows. Burroughs' grandson, Danton Burroughs, in the early 70s, found some of the film tests in his grandfather's archives. They were up in the attic. So people just throwing gold in their attic. It's wonderful. Yeah, so he finds the test footage and it's incredible. You can see it. It's out there. It's on YouTube. It's widely available. Again, it's like animatics. It's not like fully fleshed out, but you get an idea of where their heads were at in the mid-30s when they're trying to produce this. It's very interesting stuff. You got to go look at it. Had Princess of Mars had been released, it would have come out, the timing would have been right after Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It's one of those things where the Princess of Mars as a full-length feature, imagine that following Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Does it play? Is it too weird? Is it too high fantasy for a country that shortly will be going into World War II? Is, you know, like, it's kind of weird. The Disney stuff works because, you know, you're dealing with the great, you know, it's Depression era. So people are looking for ways to escape their daily terrible lives. And I think that A Princess of Mars would have just been too heady. It would have been just too much. People want to go to the cinema. They want to have a good time, watch some cartoons. I'll be honest, in 1931, the world probably was not ready. Now, like, anime is so popular. It's just another genre. Now, during the late 1950s, stop-motion animation effects director Ray Harryhausen expressed interest in filming the novels. But it was not until the 80s that producers Mario Casar and Andrew Vajna bought the rights for Walt Disney Studios via Synergy Pictures. Going back to another episode, Mario Casar and Andrew Vajna. Those are the guys that own Carlico. And for a brief period of time, made stuff like Universal Soldier, Rambo 3, Total Recall, Basic Instinct, and then they just kind of like fizzled out. By the time it's the mid-90s, they're just done. They're basically at this point in the 80s, they're looking for a competitor to Star Wars and Conan the Barbarian. We need something that's like a cross-section of those things. So Ted Elliott and Terry Rossio were hired to write the first real modern screenplay of John Carter. Originally attached, I'm going to say, I think Tom Cruise goes and does Legend instead of this, but this was originally in development with John McTiernan, previous episode, directed Last Action Hero, and Tom Cruise. They were going to have Tom Cruise as John Carter. And this became like a studio package. This was a project that was in active development. It wasn't just like, oh, they threw it around. Like, we need to get this. This is okay. We like Cruise. We like McTiernan. This is going to work. The project collapses, though, because McTiernan realized that visual effects were not advanced enough. It's like 84, 85. And he's just like, I don't think we can do this. Even if we had $50 million, which would have been a huge budget in the early, mid-80s, he just didn't think it was going to be possible. And it's funny because this is a theme that keeps coming up in the evolution of this project from page to screen. And that is, it's unfilmable. It's really a matter of opinion, because if someone has the ingenuity, what you might deem as impossible, they might just do it and knock it out of the park. Basically, they don't want to try and recreate Burroughs' vision of Barsoom. The project stays at Disney, and Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was running the show with his buddy Michael Eisner at the time, he was a strong proponent of filming these novels because it's kicked around again. Well, if McTiernan can't pull it off in live action, maybe we should go back the animated route. And Disney's in a weird place. This is when they do Black Cauldron. Disney's not in a good place either in the mid-80s. Robert Zemeckis, director of Back to the Future, Roger Rabbit, he's a legend. In the early 2000s, Zemeckis is approached. Basically, one of John Carter's producers recalled, you know, linking up with Zemeckis on the Universal backlot. And he says, you know, what can I do to get you interested in doing John Carter? And Zemeckis straight out told this guy, he says, I don't think so. There's no movie to be made here. And he's like, George Lucas has already plundered these movies. That was it. That kind of said it all. So much of the Barsoom series is in the Star Wars films and the Star Wars extended universe, the comic books, the toys, everything. There is a direct lineage, and it's okay. It's normal. What does Tarantino do? What do we all do? What is all great artists are just interpreting other artists' work. They're working it out in their own way. Their psyche, their dreams, their passions, their fears. They're working these things out. The deal would have been Zemeckis with Amblin producing, Kathleen Kennedy, good pal Stevie Spielberg, and they basically turned it down. Disney was like, at this point, Disney's like, oh shit. That's number one. You got Zemeckis, he's hot. He's made a lot of big money movies at that point. It's still the early 2000s. At this point, if the biggest player in the game, and I, no matter what you say, the biggest player in the game is always Steven Spielberg, because whatever he attaches his name to will get made and it'll make money. He's a very savvy businessman, and people forget, not only did he make amazing movies, but even like everything he produced, whether it was Gremlins or Transformers, has pretty much turned to gold. Now we get into the Paramount effect, or the Paramount effort, as I like to call it. Producer James Jax read Harry Knowles' autobiography, which lavishly praised the John Carter of Mars series. Having read the Burroughs novels as a child, Jax was moved to convince Paramount to acquire the film rights. Like, hey, look, Disney's not doing anything with this. Let's grab this. We'll get it for a song. As in everything in Hollywood, a lot of times it just becomes a dick measuring contest. They get into a bidding war because Sony, Columbia, TriStar, they find out. They're like, hey, did you hear that Paramount's trying to buy fucking John Carter? Like, get out of town. After all these years, that unadaptable thing that could never get made, put a bid in. So now Paramount and Columbia are in this bidding war to buy John Carter from Disney. After Paramount and Jax, they win the rights. Jax contacted Knowles to become an advisor on the project. Yes, this is the canceled, aforementioned, ain't it cool news, Harry Knowles. I'm not going to try to give him any more ink than he deserves. He changed the game, but ended up being a terrible human being. And he was very influential for a period in time. I mean, Rainn Wilson quasi played him in Entourage. There is this moment. Harry Knowles has a moment, and this is that moment. It's the geeks shall inherit the earth. That's what the early 2000s are about. Big Bang Theory. We want to see ourselves, and nerds want to see themselves. And this was the ultimate nerd now getting to work on a fucking Paramount picture. And yo, that's dope. If somebody came to me, some studio were like, look, Jerry, we need you to remake the cult classic Invasion USA with Chuck Norris. Can you do it? Can you make it happen? I'll do my best. Noted historian Jerry Hara. Yo, and by the way, I just wanted to say, guys, you can call me Jerry because that's what my friends call me, but my real name is Gerald Finari. I needed to restate that. You know what I'm saying? It's been a while. Okay. So here we are, kids. Knowles has become an advisor on the project. Now that it's over at Paramount, they're saying to themselves, who can we get attached to direct? Robert Rodriguez. Come on. Spy Kids? Everybody knows Spy Kids. From Dusk Till Dawn, the Mariachi trilogy, Planet Terror, one of my favorites. Oh, Sin City. See, that is the thing. Like, when you crack even Alita Battle Angel, sick flick. When you crack open that treasure chest of Robert Rodriguez, you're like, Jesus Christ, this guy's machete. You see what I'm saying? Like, these might not be your top tier shit, but they're all great movies. So you got Rodriguez on board. It's 2004. He's super hot at the time. His friend, Harry Knowles, showed him the script. Recognizing that Knowles had been an advisor to many other filmmakers, Rodriguez asked him to be credited as a producer. This is the rise. I mean, shit, the movie doesn't get made, but Harry Knowles got a fucking producer's credit on a Paramount picture. Not bad for a guy who grew up as a nerd in the middle of Texas. Filming was set to begin in 2005 with Rodriguez planning to use the all-digital stages that he had used for the film Sin City. Obviously, that was the movie that was based on the graphic novel by Frank Miller. Rodriguez planned to hire Frank Frazetta, the popular Burroughs and fantasy illustrator, as a designer on the film. I love Frazetta. I mean, he's one of the greatest artists, period. Again, it's like, it's not pulp, it's not comic book. He's a great artist. Rodriguez previously stirred up film industry controversy, owing his decision to credit Sin City's artist, Frank Miller, as the co-director of the film adaptation. And a lot of the unions did not like that. A lot of people in Hollywood did not like that. As a result, Rodriguez decides to resign from the Directors Guild of America. So in 2004, Paramount is not able to employ a non-DGA filmmaker. And Paramount then assigns Kerry Conran to direct and Aaron Kruger to rewrite the script. So again, here we are. It's 2004 and it ain't happening. Paramount goes to the Australian outback and they were using that to possible shooting locations. Can the outback look like Mars? Director Conran, she leaves the film for unknown reasons and then is replaced in October of 2005 by none other than Jumpin' Jonny Favreau. That's right. The Favs. Before the Favs had Iron Man. And it's crazy because this dovetails into that. We'll get there. He did Zathura. They're like, this guy can do genre stuff. Favreau and screenwriter Mike Fergus wanted to make the script faithful to Burroughs' novels, retaining John Carter's links to the American Civil War and ensuring that the Barsoomian Tharks were 15 feet tall. Previous scripts had had them at human size. These were gigantic creatures, kind of like that other movie. Favreau argued that a modern-day soldier would not know how to fence or ride a horse like Carter, who had been a Confederate officer. He wouldn't have that kind of advanced combat. But who cares? This is like Errol Flynn stuff. You know, this is like dashing, daring, do. Favreau is trying to adapt it in a very realistic fashion. He's not embracing the camp and the pulp novel aspect of it. Basically, Favreau, the first film he envisions would have adapted the first three novels in the Barsoom series. It would have been Princess of Mars, The Gods of Mars, and The Warlord of Mars. So basically, what he was looking to do was turn those three novels into the first film. Basically, kind of buffet style, picking what worked, what didn't work. And unlike Rodriguez and Conran, Favreau preferred using practical effects. He was not really interested in doing CGI for this film. He was going to use some makeup as well, obviously prosthetic stuff, very little. He was going to use CGI to embellish the Tharks, the creatures. And I think that's probably maybe a better way, because what happens is like CGI is not all the way there yet, especially in the early 2000s. So if you use CGI at that point as a tool to enhance what's there, I think it works better. If you tell me I'm going to put a real-life human person, whether it's in prosthetic makeup or it's a puppet versus CGI, there's more depth. Humans recognize other humans. And they might be some weird mystical creature, but you can look into their eyes. You know that there is a human there. And I think that's a problem. In August 2006, Paramount chose not to renew the film rights, preferring instead to focus on the Star Trek franchise. So you see, like, the studios are like fucking children with big shiny toys. We've played enough with this, John Carter. Let's go back to making Star Trek. They get JJ. We already know, like, if you know the story of what happens and he reboots it, whatever. Favreau and Fergus moved on to a little Marvel film called Iron Man. Most of these efforts ultimately stalled in development hell. Development hell is like the active word for John Carter. In the late 2000s, I think we're around like 2008, Walt Disney begins a concerted effort to adapt the Burroughs works to film. After an abandoned venture in the 1980s, they knew that this was the time to get the rights back to the character and really explore it. They think this is going to be their golden goose now. So the project is entirely driven by director Andrew Stanton. And he had basically pressed Disney. He does all these movies, Bug's Life, Finding Nemo, Wally. What do you want to do? And he's like, I want to do John Carter. And they're like, what? Like, we used to own the rights to that. So he's like, get him back. He's like, if they're not doing anything with it, let's pursue this license. Let's renew the screen rights from the Burroughs estate. Let's make this happen. So I think it became one of those things where it has languished long enough at Paramount. They had X amount of time to get this movie made, and they didn't do it. In 2009, Stanton becomes the official director for John Carter. We're going in. We're in pre-production now. It would be his live-action debut after his directorial work, obviously on the seminal films mentioned, from Finding Nemo to Wally. Filming begins in November of 2009. Principal photography underway in January of 2010. And then ultimately the picture wrapped 7 months later in July. And there's a reason that I'm giving you this timeline, but we'll get to that. Stanton's got he basically can do whatever he wants. He's got a huge budget. Dude, you made us like $1 billion. And here's the thing, man. You make a studio $1 billion, you're getting a blank check. You're getting a blank check movie. They're going to say, what do you want to do? It's what's ultimately going to happen to Greta Gerwig. We're going to give you a 3-picture deal. You can two pictures. You can do whatever you want. Make whatever fucking family film. Do whatever you want. But you're going to give us Barbie too. And we need Barbie too. And because you're giving us Barbie too, you got some creative freedom to make whatever you want, as long as it's at a budget where everyone feels comfortable, meaning it's not going to be a Barbie budget. It's going to be much less. And by much less, I mean zip, zero, zilch. So Stanton goes on record. He says, since I had read the books as a kid, I wanted to see somebody put it on the screen. So this has kind of been his dream. This is the one. This is it. He wanted this. Stanton like worked tirelessly to make this happen. This wasn't a case where it's like, oh, this is a license. This is a franchise. Would you? No, he pressed. They said, what do you want to do? He says, I want to do John Carter. Now we realize all these years later, going back to the 1930s, that this project, whether it was an animated film, whether it was going to be Robert Zemeckis, it just couldn't, nobody, it was complete failure to launch. Basically, we're getting into making this movie finally. And Stanton was basically pitching this movie. He's like, this is going to be our new Indiana Jones, which is crazy because they hadn't bought Lucasfilm yet. But that was the way that Stanton had envisioned it. You know, we were going to go on multiple adventures with this character through the course of time. Studio was skeptical, even though they were like, we're going to do this for you because you made us $1 billion, but we were really not super comfortable with it just because of the history of the film. Stanton also didn't want to make the movie with major stars. He wanted to cast unknowns so that they wouldn't have any kind of like preconceived notion as far as the actors would go. Oh, that's the guy from NYPD Blue. He wanted people that were largely unknown. That was a part of his strategy because you were going to buy into these characters. If we cast Sylvester Stallone as John Carter, he's not really John Carter. It's Sylvester Stallone or Vin Diesel or whoever the fuck you know, like, if that probably was a move. Like, let's take a guy who's an action hero and let's, but ultimately they don't do that. Disney was kind of like, well, we're not going to have any names to open this movie. Yeah. He's like, we're using the movie as the product, as the vessel in order to launch the franchise. He goes, we're going to make stars out of the people who are in this. The screenplay, though, that was produced was seen as confusing and difficult to follow. The people at Disney were like, what is this? Believe it or not, Stanton had to overcome similar pre-production doubts to make Wally and Finding Nemo. It was the same thing. Disney was like, wait, what is this? What are we doing? Like, it's a little robot? Wait, what? It becomes a thing in Stanton's career that he has to make all these notes. He has to draw pictures and show them, like, this is what I'm doing. And they're like, huh? What? You want money? It's like an old lady running Disney. Just give Andrew Stanton some money so he can make John Carter. He's been a very good boy. John Lasseter, another canceled guy. Genius, absolute genius. Stanton's deal was with Pixar. It wasn't with Disney. Essentially, John Lasseter had to lend out Stanton. Like, there actually had to be like formal agreements made for him to direct this movie. And Pixar is like an all ages brand. And John Carter, in Stanton's words, was not going to be an all ages film. That was one thing. Stanton was kind of like, I'd really like to make this a PG-13, possibly an R, you know, a little more, you know, for the adults. Disney was never going to go for that. As much as they'll push that PG-13 rating, I don't think at that point Disney was ready to make an R-rated, mega-budget sci-fi adaptation. By 2008, the first draft for part one of a John Carter film trilogy was completed. And again, that was the other rub, was it's going to be a trilogy. Because Stanton is like, I can't tell this story in one movie. I need three movies. And of course, Disney's like, we'll get a trilogy out of this, just like Star Wars. This will be really good. Boy, oh boy, I wish we had Star Wars. And eventually they would. See, you knew that, though, because you're listening to The Offering. You're tuned into that kind of cool stuff, that inside info.
We'll be right back with more of The Offering with Jerry Horror.
Now, the most definitive account of the films made by the most infamous and influential studios of the 1980s, Canon Films. The Canon Film Guide Volumes 1 and 2 gives you the true stories from the people who made them, and truth is stranger than fiction. From American ninjas to masters of the universe, from Charles Bronson to Chuck Norris, from Bloodsport to Texas Chainsaw 2, take it over the top on your Superman 4 quest for peace. These books have got it all, folks. A passionate journey through the highs and lows of pure 80s goodness. The Canon Film Guide illustrates all the behind-the-scenes mayhem of one of the most beloved cult movie factories of all time. We at The Offering highly recommend these books. They are essential reading for any and all film buffs. The Canon Film Guide, Volume 1 and 2, available now at Amazon, iTunes, or wherever finer books are sold.
RetroSource Long Island is taking you back. Take a trip back in time with their custom-built store paying tribute to the best decades of all time, the 80s and the 90s. They have a massive collection of video games to choose from, spanning from Atari 2600 to Nintendo Switch, not to mention a large selection of toys, plushies, art, collectibles, board games, and so much more. They've got a friendly and quirky staff that loves to talk to you all about your favorite movies, cartoons, and TV shows that you grew up with. Check out their funny skits on their Instagram at RetroSourceLI. Do you love E.T., Thundercats, Back to the Future, Masters of the Universe, RoboCop, Street Fighter, Knight Rider, Ninja Turtles, Pokemon, Power Rangers? Yeah, man, RetroSource has got you covered. Take a photo in their Saved by the Bell high school locker display. It's totally mint. Spend hours playing arcade games while getting a sugar rush from vintage candy and soda. It's gnarly, buddy. Located at 1075 Portion Road in Farmingville, New York, RetroSource, Long Island's most radical shopping experience.
You're listening to The Offering with Jerry Hara. Got a question or a story you want to share with me? It might be featured in a future episode. Email me at jerryhara@gmail.com or hit me up on Twitter at Jerry Hara. I'm also on Instagram. You can find me there at Jerry Hara. Rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts, and you might find your review in an upcoming episode. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to The Offering. Now back to the show.
In April 2009, author Michael Chabon confirmed that he had been hired to revise the script. They weren't happy with it. To say the least, Disney was not happy with Andrew Stanton's first script. "I'm really good at structure and collaborating," Stanton said, "but Michael is just technically, poetically, and intelligence-wise a better writer." Wow, he really fucking put Chabon over there, huh? He's just like, "I'm a talentless piece of shit, maybe even what you would call a hack. But Chabon, he's incredible." Following the completion of WALL-E, Stanton visited the archives of Edgar Rice Burroughs in Tarzana, California, as a part of his research. Jim Morris, who was the general manager of Pixar at the time, said that the film would have a unique look.
distinct from Frazetta's illustrations, which they both found dated. So this is already, we're making mistakes here. We don't like that shit. That's amazing. And it's an absolute classic. Let's do our own thing. So we're going to get away from the Frazetta designs. He also noted that altogether, he had less time for pre-production than any of his usual animated projects. You know, usually you've got this gigantic window because animation takes a lot longer. It's gotten faster and faster because of computers and technology, but still, making those Pixar films in the early 2000s, they were like a solid like 4 to 5 years of work, you know, from Rooter to the Tutor. I'm sorry, guys. I'm trying to get this over. I told producer Pete, I'm like, we're going to have a Rooter to the Tutor t-shirt. Hopefully that happens, you know. We were talking about this. Where the hell were we? So nobody wants to use Frazetta's designs. And the task, nevertheless, was easy for Stanton because he understood how this all worked. He had been working out his own animatic in his head and even sketching. He was basically sketching out every minute of the screenplay. Stanton had read Burroughs novels as a child. He was ready since he was a little kid. He had the whole movie in his head, essentially. So to prepare for directing, he decided he was going to lose 20 pounds and start running 15 miles a week and never go to his trailer or sit down when absolutely necessary to avoid looking like the privileged animation geek who had cheated his way to the top. So he feels like, I've got to lose weight. I've got to look better. I've got to feel better because now I'm not just sitting around eating munchkins at a desk animating things. You know, I guess it's that process is obviously different. It's like the indoor kids versus the outdoor kids. The indoor kids are the animation people, the people who make video games. Stanton said later, there was no grand design for the cast other than having the villains to be played by British actors. How fucking original. I knew that the cast was going to grow with creatures and is going to grow with different types of races if we decided to continue. We would just keep introducing new species. And it was going to get a little bit more fantastical as we went along. He kind of knew that the budget would balloon. Each movie introduced new aliens, new worlds, so they became increasingly expensive, which is never a recipe for disaster. So a lot of people were considered to play the role of John Carter, aware that Carter's backstory as an officer in the Confederate Army might be a problem for modern audiences. You know, because the South. Stanton envisioned the character as disillusioned and disgusted with war. He, apart from the side that he fought on, I wanted not to absolve him of that, but also not make him pro to the side he was on. The best we could do was neutralize him. He wasn't going to be the North or the South. He was just going to be a confused, you know, like it's, this is where things become problematic because you have certain staples that are integral to the origin of a character. So now he's not a Confederate soldier. He's in the middle. He's like, I don't like war because that was a popular thing. We were learning after the 20-year occupation of Afghanistan and all these other places that we should have never been in to begin with. So it was going to be kind of one of those things where he's the soldier. He's like, I don't want to fight. You know, I'm not really into this fighting. What do you guys say? Make some pancakes. So Taylor Kitsch quickly became his choice for the part. So there's a little show called Friday Night Lights. It was based on the film adaptation. I've seen the film. Didn't really do much for me. I heard the show's great. I just have to be completely honest because like I don't know anything about it. I really don't care less. Sounds like white people problems to me. Ha ha. Can that be a t-shirt too? Rooted to the Tutor and white people problems. I've been canceled. Harry Knowles is having me over tonight for some spinach dip. So there's this scene in an episode where Kitsch's character gets angry and he was left behind by the bus of his teammates. Stanton sees that and he's like, yo, this kid can act, number one. Number two, he's handsome and he has the physicality, so I think we found the guy. This scene really captured Stanton's vision. He sees Kitsch on that show and he starts sketching him. He starts just automatically drawing him, and it goes into that visual toolbox that Stanton has. That's his gift. Tom Cruise, now again,
because goddamn this movie. It's like every time when I think that we're like, hey, we're almost there, we're going to make the movie, it's like, nope, there's another wrinkle in the story. Tom Cruise had expressed interest, and this was right around the time that they were casting Kitsch. Stanton was like, hey, let's get Taylor to do this. And Disney was like, yeah, but if we get Tom Cruise, a lot more butts in the seats. And it didn't work out for timing reasons or whatever. And Disney really wanted that. They really wanted Cruise, but it wasn't going to happen. Let's be honest. And then Stanton's defense was, Tom Cruise going to cost a lot of money. Don't want to pay that Cruise money. And they were like, oh, Cruise is going to cost money. But it might actually pull people in for a bigger opening for this type of film. Personally, when you've got a film that is high concept like this, think like Chronicles of Riddick, you need somebody. At that point, Vin Diesel was a gigantic star. He was, you know, just hot off the Fast and the Furious film, Triple X. And it's one of those things like, we're going to double down. And it's the reason Chronicles of Riddick, that's another blank check movie. We'd really like to have you back for another Fast movie. It's like, well, maybe. I'm doing Stallone as Vin Diesel. Like, I have to smoke like a half a pack of Newports and I can do Vin Diesel. I don't know. I'm not even going to attempt to do it. My balls haven't dropped yet. Disney didn't believe in Taylor Kitsch. They wanted a bigger star, but ultimately they believe in Stanton's vision. Disney was thinking they could get three movies out of this guy for the cost of one Tom Cruise. We can get the whole trilogy for the price of Tom Cruise. And then we can have him voice terrible shit. Oh, you're going to be the clock in the new Disney Beauty and the Beast. You know how they work over there. We got to create brand synergy. And we think that Taylor Kitsch would perfectly play a clock in our next animated piece of shit. Who wants to spend triple the amount when you can get Taylor Kitsch? You know what I'm saying? It's bargain basement prices comparatively to a big star. They figured Disney's whole thing was like, all right, we're going to sell this guy as a matinee idol. Like, we need to get teen girls sexually excited by the sight of this. So they started putting a lot of money into PR and getting him into all the magazines and really kind of soft pitching him to the public as a matinee idol. And that was appealing to them because they're like, oh, well, you know, Walt Disney and Kurt Russell in the 70s, they always kind of sold some kind of handsome young guy. That was always a part. It was Jeff Bridges and Tron. You know, that was kind of always their thing. By all accounts, the people who made this movie are still friends till this day. Everybody got along. Like, that's the crazy thing. This whole movie has a crazy story of getting made, but everybody, Lily Collins plays the female lead, Taylor Kitsch and Stanton, still talk to each other, still hang out, which I think is like the coolest thing. Here's the other thing. And this was the wrinkle on the whole production. Andrew Stanton was a fucking animator. He's not used to directing live action people. So it became one of these things like by the end of the production, they were calling him, you know, like Kubrick, Stanley Kubrick, because he did like hundreds of takes. Insane, like just burning daylight trying to get one scene done because it was never... He's used to controlling these characters. He's used to, you know, really being more like a god who's creating this dream for you to watch with animation. In this case, you can't do that. You can't control with your pencil. You can't, you know, you need to be in touch with what's happening in a physical sense. So other than that complaint, it was a pleasant production. Principal photography began at Long Cross Studio in London, January 2010, and they ended the shoot with a lot of the exteriors, the Mars exteriors, which were Kanab, Utah. I can't even say that, Kanab. So yeah, took a long time to get this movie done, mainly because a lot of it, like, yeah, there's effect stuff, but they were shooting on some of the sound stages in London, but a lot of this was like practically shot outdoors in Utah, which... I think if they made this movie today, it would probably be like 20 to 30% more soundstage than being shot practically. But again, 2009, 2010, yeah, we're not doing things like they do with The Mandalorian or these Marvel shows where it's just all shot in a digital world, a digital bath. So cinematographer Dan Mindell believed that the entire movie should have been shot in the Four Corners region of the southwestern U.S. He feels that it was the only place on Earth that felt could convincingly pass for Mars. And ultimately, due to budgetary reasons, that was not going to be feasible. Utah was willing to offer Disney like this huge tax credit. So they're like, all right, we'll shoot the whole thing. Guess what? Utah is Mars now. Why? Because they gave us an incentive. We got a, you know, a right to work state that, sorry, I got a little out of control there. The movie was shot on 35mm. Again, would be shot digitally today, which was the look that Stanton wanted. He ultimately realized with all the takes he was doing, though, that film had become a nightmare. Because if you've worked with 35mm, got to keep reloading those cameras. It's a thing. So for a guy who's doing 100 takes on a scene, not the guy you want to be shooting on film, because that will become fucking laborious. Work on the visual effects had already begun even earlier. They started on the animatics in 2009, before the release of Avatar, which essentially revolutionizes the field. We joke around, blah, 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 about Avatar. But here's the thing, man. That first movie is hugely influential to filmmaking. Movies are never made quite the same after the shockwaves are felt from the way CG is handled in that movie. Basically, Avatar comes out and blew the effects team's mind, and they had to start from scratch. So they're like, they're halfway into doing the CGI, the animatics, all this stuff. And then Avatar drops, and it's just like, what the fuck? What are we going to do? We're making a film that's kind of similar with aliens and an alien world. And they're like, oh, it's blue, it's jungles, it looks lush, it's really alive. Well, we're shooting out in the middle of Utah and putting some kind of green, grayish aliens. Yeah, oh, because you know me, I'm the 3D authority. Everybody knows that. You want to talk about 3D films, you come talk to Jerry. They were shooting with a 3D release in mind, because also what happens too is Avatar is a 3D movie. So that really jumpstarts the craze of the 2000s with 3D. A year before principal photography begins, Disney makes this choice. They're like, nah, we're not going to shoot it in 3D. And they ultimately like regret it. It's like, fuck. Like Avatar just made $1 billion and we didn't decide to do what they did. So basically the camera crew and effects specialists, they're looking at Disney's Alice in Wonderland and they're using that kind of as a template with the 3D process that they had in mind. They realized though that those same processes that could be used for film would be outdated. It's kind of one of these things where they had planned to shoot it in 3D, but by the time that this movie comes out, the technology is largely invalid. Because Avatar has basically jumped it up so far that there's no way for them to compete in such a short amount of time. The movie's made, and they do some test screenings, and the test screenings go horrible. People fucking hated this movie for whatever reason. And this is legendary on the Disney lot for many years. The July 2011 preview screening. So initially, expectations of the film's commercial success were high. Disney's like, oh, we got a winner here. Dude, fucking Avatar just made $1 billion. This thing's going to be a hit. Studio holds a sneak preview in mid-2011 over in Portland, Oregon. This is before they're about to do a big reshoot. And Stanton, who's been diagnosed with high-functioning attention deficit disorder, was still early in the process of rewriting the script. For nervousness, he would take lorazepam, which is kind of like a sedative. It's in the benzo family, like Xanax. He decides to take one of these lorazepam pills before the screening. Gets on the plane, takes the pills, and then four Disney executives were in attendance, and they watched the reaction of 400 filmgoers and their opinions afterwards. And he's all fucked up because he basically took this pill for anxiety to go on the flight, and it's basically like a bad trip. You get on the plane, you show up for the preview screening, you're there with all the brass, basically your bosses, and you're all fucked up. Because he has ADD, so it's like he takes a downer, and the downer just really washes the poor guy out. It becomes nightmarish because this crowd turned on the movie. Basically, there were 400 people in attendance for this screening. The audience reactions seem to indicate that the audiences were engaged with the film and they laughed when they were supposed to. Stanton was like, all right, you know what? They're responding to it. We'll read the scorecards, but whatever. What audiences did not like, what they saw, was when Disney mandated reshoots immediately, which would take place that September. So after this test screening happens, they go through all the cards, and it says very good or excellent. For an average audience, an overall rating of 75% is good. So if you're 75% or higher, that's exactly what the studio wants to see. That's what they're encouraged by. Okay, the audience responded, this is going to make money. It's a good movie. It was said that in some cases during that screening, it could have been rounded up to 80, reflecting that work was still yet to be done. Like, we could do better, because that's Disney. That's any major corporation who's making a product is, well, we did pretty good, but we can do better. So according to the preview cards, that work would also include improving the pacing of the film, making a little bit of the story more clear, and developing the relationship a little bit more between Carter and Thoris so that the wedding at the end was not so much of a surprise. They basically wanted the film to be more formulaic, easier for the average Joe to understand. And it's funny that we're talking about this because we go back all those years in the 1930s, people are not going to get this. Well, guess what? It's 2011, we're at preview screenings, and Disney is telling everyone, people are not going to get this. Were they right? Were they wrong? I don't know. For whatever reason, Disney insists we need more connective footage. The dummies in the back row are not going to get this fucking movie. No one will know what this is. They don't get it. And again, you have to realize most studios, most corporations see the average person as being a complete moron. And in some cases, they are complete morons. I mean, come on, you're listening to this show. That says it all. You know, your self-worth. You really got to examine that. So before the first formal reshoot, which takes place throughout September in the Los Angeles neighborhood of Playa Vista, Stanton told The New Yorker he had done some smaller scale reshooting, focusing on additional dialogue for some characters in order to address the issues with the preview that had been raised. Stanton reshot most of the movie twice, far more than was common for live action. So now this is where things start to go off the rails. He's doing these reshoots, but he's basically shooting at a maniacal pace in order to correct the movie in his eyes based on the audience reaction. During these reshoots, he makes almost like another half of a movie, if that makes sense. He basically is trying to course correct all the problems that Disney had with the film and all the problems that the audience had. And this is dangerous. This is dangerous for artists to do this kind of stuff. Sometimes it pays off. Frank Oz's original apocalyptic version of Little Shop of Horror, it didn't work. It doesn't play. You can watch it on the Blu-ray. That down ending doesn't work. That's good use. That's good use of, oh no, we got to tighten up this movie. That sequence was 15 minutes. Cut it out. Let's give him, you know, Seymour a happy ending. And it's dangerous when you start doing stuff like this, because now he's going way over budget and he's reshooting half the movie. And that's not good, because what happens is if you've already got a movie and then you got another half of a movie, it doesn't help. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, you can use things, you can, through the magic of editing, you can create, you know, new sequences and make more connective tissue. But ultimately, this thing is not going to work. More does not always mean better. Sometimes in a lot of these situations, you shoot as much as you can and you chop it down so that it has a cohesive story and decent pacing. So New Yorker writer Tad Friend, real name Tad Friend, visited the set during the reshoot and wrote an article about it, noting that it was unusually extensive and expensive, even for a major studio like Disney. Collins and Kitsch both made comments on the record about the reshoot that seemed defensive. Stanton told Friend, not only if that it had been up to him, he would have insisted on a second reshoot, but these reshoots would have been mandatory. In fact, if I could, I would like to shoot a lot of the movie a second time. That's not good. That's not what you tell the guy at the New Yorker. So it's very obvious. Tad Friend, who's the writer, he's like, this is off the rails. You're reshooting most of what you had already done. Everybody knows that there's a completed version of this movie. So why are you going back? This is where the rumors start and the buzz begins. Dude, it's John Carter. It's not good. Guy's reshooting the movie. That's not good. And it becomes one of these things too, where now, like Kitsch and everybody else that is involved with this movie, like, okay, well, you shot the movie and it took 7 to 10 months. Well, now it's going to take another 6 months. You lock your actors and everybody gets locked and stuck into this production. And that happens. Hey, look, you get a check, but at the same time, it can be a bit of madness because when you're working on a big tentpole movie like this, a big supposed summer blockbuster, it's got to be right. They're spending all that money. There's no room for error. At this point, in the court of public opinion, things are not looking good for John Carter. Article drops in the New Yorker. The media narrative becomes, after that New Yorker article, is that this movie is in serious trouble. And as conventional Hollywood wisdom held that reshoots of this caliber had dictated that this movie was in big trouble and it was going to be a big flop. Movie's not even out yet. And that's already the prevalent narrative, that this is bad. Collins believes that the reshoot was detrimental for her character. Originally filmed as a strong, independent woman, the scenes added, such as those with her father, made her seem more sexualized and vulnerable. Those scenes, which basically she had slapped Carter and was more, kind of had this fiery female energy, all that stuff was cut. She believes the studio wanted a softer take. They wanted a pretty girl. They wanted a damsel in distress. So when they do the reshoots and they do the recut, they turn this character, who is more kind of like a Rachel Weisz in The Mummy, kind of a character, where they soften her down. They're like, okay, we don't need a female hero. We just need a pretty girl who can kiss the guy at the end. And that's kind of what happens. They, you know, look, is it right? Is it wrong? I don't know. I'm not telling the story. I'm telling the story of the production, but I'm not making the movie. After the reshoot, considerable work had to be redone in post-production on Stanton's first cut. The first cut of John Carter was 3 hours and 12 minutes. There were many effects and CGI shots to finish, which had to be changed because, again, he was an animator, and in his mind, he's working on the fly, so he's like, we got to change all this CGI. This stuff is not working for me. And basically, people who worked on this movie were like, the amount of work we put into the CGI was almost like what would have been 3 or 4 years of making an animated movie, but condensed into this very small window of production because we have to get this out. This needs to be a big blockbuster. Disney they've bought the promotion. It's paid for. The billboards, the cups at Burger King, it's all bought and paid for. You got to get the movie out. You are now locked to a date and you don't want to break that date. It's not good because, again, it shows weakness. It's like, well, we were going to come out on June 18th, but you know what? We're going to next August. That's a bad sign. That's an inevitable death knell for any project because, again, it shows weakness. So animating the Tharks in this CGI film, they had to create new software because they weren't able. Look, they just saw Avatar and they're realizing, shit, our CGI doesn't look good. So they had to bring in new artists, new hardware. Dude, honestly, if Stanton hadn't had as much knowledge as he had with animation, this whole thing would have been a disaster. We'd be talking about this movie now like, oof, that was some terrible CG. Kind of like another Mummy reference, The Mummy Returns, the Rock as the Scorpion King. Oh God, I still have nightmares about that thing. I fell asleep during The Mummy Returns when it first came out. And I woke up and that was the scene I saw. And I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. I'm going back to sleep. And I did. So we need a new title. There's a major issue here. And several accounts of who decided to change it and why. We can all point fingers. It's largely based on the first book in the series, A Princess of Mars. Disney says, no, we can't call it that because we have Disney princesses. And we can't have, it'll create brand confusion. The film is originally titled John Carter of Mars. Stanton changed that title from the book's title early in 2011 because not a single boy, he remarked, would want to go to Mars. Let's make it a surprise for them. Wait, what? Okay, so they're going to remove the of Mars. And Disney likes this because of search engine optimization. Oh, we'll just put it out there. It's John Carter. You know, like it's easier. It's not John Carter of Mars. They also felt that if they put the of Mars, that it would appeal to a broader audience. And it would be an origin story about a guy becoming John Carter of Mars. It makes sense. Like, I get it. Look, yo, they were afraid. Because the other thing, too, was there had been all these movies. If you remember Red Planet, Mission to Mars, all these movies that had been about Mars were largely flops. So Disney's like, oh, we don't want to call this of Mars. You know, we'll just call it Total Recall. No, I wish that. So Disney also reportedly believed that the sex appeal of the popular kitsch being shirtless throughout the movie would draw women to see this film. And since women are believed by Hollywood to be adverse to science fiction, girls don't like science fiction. In this account, Mars was excised from the title. So that was the other part. We're trying to sell Taylor Kitsch as this dreamy matinee idol. We don't need him going to Mars. He's just sexy John Carter. Where's he going? Mars. We'll talk about that later. You come buy your tickets and have some popcorn and we'll go to, yeah, we're going to Mars. But he's shirtless, so it's fine. Another reported explanation for the name change was that Disney had suffered a significant loss in March 2011 with a little film, Mars Needs Moms. And that one's terrible. Mars Needs Moms is a terrible, terrible film. And that almost got remade. That was an entirely remade animated film that just didn't work. So basically, Disney does this study and they realize that anything with the word Mars in the title, other than the candy bar company, had never been successful. The only film that made money was Total Recall. And that was set on Mars, but it didn't have it in the title. Regardless, a lot of this stuff was not going to work. And what's even crazier is if you go a lot of the early promotional materials, it was the film was originally called John Carter of Mars. So there were different items that were given out as promotional stuff. There were some early teaser posters that have the JCM. So despite the name change, if you have any of that stuff, if you find something that says John Carter of Mars, any promotional material, it's actually worth a lot of money. It's a Revenge of the Jedi situation. If you see it out there, grab it and sell it on eBay, because I guess that's what we do now. If we find things, we're like, oh my God, I found a Biker Mice from Mars action figure. What do? You go, you sell it on fucking eBay. After the film's release and subsequent failure, a truncated title was seen as a part of the problem. People were asking themselves, what the hell is John Carter? What's this film about? Like, at least when it's John Carter of Mars, we know what the movie's about. With this, we have no idea. We're just like, what is it? Los Angeles Times releases the headline, I don't know who John Carter is, and this movie does not even make that clear. So again, early word, it's bad. People went on record, like this was one of the things too that studio executives said. Nobody wanted to be John Carter that Halloween. I rest my case. Anonymous Disney executive. John Carter's failure has been blamed on its promotion. A lot of people have said it's one of the worst marketing campaigns in movie history. Critics focused on the decision to remove Princess and Mars out of fear of alienating young men. We don't want a movie called Princess with young men. Audiences didn't understand. They were like, they had to figure it out. Star Wars is Star Wars. What is Dune? What are any of these movies about? But the whole thing with the title, it just never worked. It was just cursed from the beginning. A new studio executive team with minimal experience on that side of the business was in charge of this film. They were not as emotionally invested into the success of the filmmakers. At that point, CEO Bob Iger had already begun talks with George Lucas about buying Lucasfilm and Star Wars, basically eliminating any incentive that the company had to launch a successful competing film franchise. So basically, behind the scenes, they've already got Star Wars. They're saying to themselves, gives a shit. We'll write this off as a loss. And now we got Star Wars, and that'll make money because it's made money before. So the original film release date was June 8th, 2012, and in January of 2011, they moved that release date up 3 months to March 9th of that year, basically stating to the public and obviously like the Hollywood Reporter and the trades, they're moving this thing to March. They don't think it can be a summer blockbuster. And again, we've talked about this. It shows a sign of weakness in the industry, at least. I don't know what the public perception of it is, but at that point, in January of 2011, they had made the decision. They're like, this isn't a summer movie. We want it to be, but whatever. Although the film grossed over $300 million worldwide,
it lost a considerable amount of money due to its high costs. Because again, he remade the movie like almost twice, and all the money that was spent for the CGI, which they almost did again twice. So at the time of its release, Disney claimed the film's production budget was $250 million. Although tax returns released in 2014 revealed that its exact budget was $263 million, plus $150 million in marketing. John Carter's bloated budget would have required it to generate worldwide ticket sales of more than $600 million to break even, a height reached by only 63 films in the history of filmmaking. What was the reception? As of this episode, is 52% rotten on Rotten Tomatoes and has a 60% fresh score with audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 2.5 stars out of 4, saying it's derivative but charming and fun enough. Disney's mammoth sci-fi-er is both spectacular and a bit cheesy. Here's the corporate fallout. The film's failure leads to the resignation of Rich Ross, who is the head of Walt Disney Studios. Yeah, he had to take the L. You know how this works. That's how the corporate world works. Somebody has to take, you know, it's like, it's that guy's fault. So Rich Ross, it was his fault. Ross, at one point, could have stopped the production of John Carter. He wanted to do 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea with Channing Tatum, because at that point, he was trying to minimize the budget after, like, the Lone Ranger cost them a shit ton of money. They didn't think that it would make the money that they thought it would. To me, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea with Channing Tatum sounds like a better movie. I don't know. That's just me. I like Tatum. I think that might have been something interesting. Sequels. Prior to the film's release, the filmmakers reported that John Carter was, of course, intended to be the first part of a trilogy. Due to the poor performance, Disney canceled plans for Gods of Mars and Warlords of Mars, as well as the rest of the trilogy and comic book series that Stanton had planned. In September of 2012, Stanton announced that he would be working on Finding Dory. And at that point in time, officially, he kind of put it out to the media that John Carter's sequels had been canceled. It's not going to happen. In October of 2014, Disney allowed the film rights to the Barsoom novels to revert back to the Burroughs estate, where they remain to this very day. In November 2016, Stanton stated, "I will always mourn the fact that I didn't get to make the other two films that I had planned for that series. Since I was a young boy, this was a film that I had in my head, and there was a way that I was going to express it and tell it to the audience. Unfortunately, the world of CGI and special effects hadn't caught up to the world of my young imagination." In 2022, on the film's 10th anniversary, Stanton shared with The Wrap how the sequel, Gods of Mars, would have begun. The sequel would have led to revelations that a technologically advanced race living beneath the surface was controlling the air and water to keep the planet alive. What do these shocking developments mean for John Carter and his young family? Nobody gave a shit, because here we are in 2023, and nobody had those questions. People like this film. I've rewatched this film. It's not bad. It's fine for what it is. If you look at it as an Errol Flynn throwback with a little bit of a sci-fi twist, it's fine. It's fine. To me, that's the worst thing a movie can be sometimes. And if you're good, you're good. If you're bad, you're bad. But do something. Elicit some kind of a response. When I watched this film, and I watched it in 3D, which was okay. 3D was whatever. Regardless, it's not held as a classic. Nobody remembers it. You can go watch it right now on Disney Plus. Could you do worse? Yeah. Could you do better? Yes, of course. But now it's time to get to one of my favorite parts of this show, an unhinged review. Wow. Okay, so this review is written by Paul Prano. It is a one-star review. And the title of it is, "I Wish There Was a Lesser Rating to Give." Now, this review is from April 9th of 2023. This guy's got some time on his hands. You know, producer Pete said he waited like 10 years to give this shitty review on Target. "I was excited to see a movie of Burroughs' John Carter novels. However, I do believe that Mr. Burroughs is rolling over his grave now that he sees that this hack piece of PC excrement has hit theaters. I have read the John Carter sci-fi trilogy novels twice, and in my opinion, this is crap.
It's all woke bullshit. However, Disney managed to destroy Burrow's work with this horribly, horrible PC-hacked monster. I am very, very disappointed. I wish I could have roasted a marshmallow on a burning copy of this Blu-ray. In other words, don't waste your time and money on a PC hack woke job. Woke job? Oh. And my condolences to the poor late Mr. Edward Rice Burroughs. R.I.P. Holy shit, that guy is fucking unhinged. He is upset. He is on Target.com reviewing a fucking Blu-ray from over a decade ago. Holy shit, dude. Wow. So look, I know it's convoluted. I know that it's long, but I had to do it. I had to document it. Because here is the lesson with John Carter. Andrew Stanton had a beautiful movie in his mind, but this movie is truly cursed. And I'll be honest with you, I think the only way that you could do this, if somebody had a really inspired idea and design for an animated movie or a TV series, that's the way to go. Otherwise, the problem is, whether it's Avatar or Star Wars, like Zemeckis said, it's been strip mined. There's really nothing left. You've seen John Carter of Mars, just in like 50 other movies and television shows. And it sucks, because there was something really original and probably something really special. And I think TLC said it best. You gotta stick to the lakes and the rivers that you're used to, right? Don't go chasing the ocean or waterfalls. Sorry, that was terrible. Yeah, I'm sorry, kids. It's been a long episode. Uncle Jerry doesn't have good shit. But yeah, that's kind of the conceit of this whole movie. It was unadaptable. They never should have done it, but they did. And then Disney just doesn't care. Like a year or two later, they're already working on Star Wars. They're already doing Marvel. And it's over. They're making a new Tron, because that was the whole thing. Like, Pirates and Tron made a lot of money. So they're like, okay, well, we're going to keep doing things, you know, based on rides. And they try. They just dropped that Haunted Mansion movie. It wasn't terrible. It wasn't very good either. It was just mid, as the kids say. John Carter is streaming on Disney Plus. But do you really give a shit? I don't know. I think the stories about John Carter are far more interesting than anything that Disney Plus has to offer me. Speaking of which, this has been The Offering with me, your host, Jerry Hara. I hope that you have enjoyed yourself. I hope that you learned a lot with this episode. I know it's dense. I know it's a lot to go through, but I think ultimately it's worth it. Because you know what? If you're waiting right now at an airport or you're on the train, I'm coming in clutch to save your day. So you can thank me later. I'm Jerry Hara. This is The Offering. Mostly horror, always genre. You've been listening to The Offering with Jerry Hara. I'm very sorry. Produced by Pete Bune. If you have a question or a story you want to share with me, we'd love to hear from you. You can email me at jerryhara@gmail.com or hit us up at Twitter @jerryhara or on Instagram @jerryhara. You getting the picture? Subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are provided for you and your family. I want you to enjoy. Just join us next time for another offering.
This has been a Sick Boy Wolfgang production. Thank you for listening.